Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. It's 4 years now since mad cow disease was discovered in Alberta. Since that time, a tremendous effort has gone into trying to understand the cause behind this and other prion-related ailments, and what can be done to avoid them. Two scientists heading various prion research initiatives in Alberta are Dr. David Westaway and Dr. Stephen Moore. Their story is coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Mad cow disease is just one of several spongiform diseases that literally destroy the brains of the organisms they attack. The common cause is misfolded prions, bits of protein that for some reason run amok in mammals. A lot of scientific research is focused now on the genetic component of prion diseases. Dr. David Westaway is a molecular biologist who has come to the province to head the new Center for Prions and Prion-Folding Diseases at the University of Alberta. David is also an Alberta Ingenuity Prion Institute scholar.
Well, for prion diseases, we're interested in how these diseases are inherited, so we take a genetic approach to these diseases, but we are particularly interested in the different types of prion proteins, and the prion proteins are a sort of a precursor, a healthy, benign precursor to the rogue prion proteins that cause the destructive, infectious forms of the diseases.
And you're also looking at Alzheimer's too.
Yes, we've been interested in Alzheimer's disease for a number of years. Started that at the University of Toronto, and we'll continue some aspects of the study of Alzheimer's disease here. There we are interested in an enzyme that's implicated in the genesis, the origins of Alzheimer's disease, and we are also interested in a long-term goal to provide very accurate animal models of Alzheimer's disease.
Do you see there being a relationship between the prion diseases and Alzheimer's?
There are tantalizing similarities in the chemical properties of the proteins that underlie these two types of diseases. So we study the similar chemical properties of the proteins. On a practical level, there is there are reasons where we call them two different diseases. It's not really one overlapping mega disease. They are different diseases, and the key point is that prion diseases are transmissible. They can spread from a person to a person or an animal to an animal by an infectious route, whereas that is not the case for Alzheimer's disease.
What do you see as being the state of affairs or our state of knowledge at this point with relationship to the prion diseases? We look a few years ago in Alberta, we had our mad cow scare, as it were. Where are we now in terms of what we know about this disease?
Well, we hope that the mad cow scare crisis is a thing of the past, that we can put that behind us with rather more increased vigilance for the disease and different preemptive measures to stop this spreading. In terms of emerging prion disease, we are keeping a vigilant eye on another type of disease called chronic wasting disease that exists in elk and different types of deer. We don't quite know how that situation is developing, so we're keeping a close eye on it. So that is a practical concern. On, I suppose, more the sort of science theory front, we know in broad brush strokes how prion diseases work, and we know at a sort of low level of resolution that they are due to changes in the shapes of protein. We have cellular, what we would call cellular prion proteins, that are a component of our bodies and presumably help our brain cells in some ways, but these proteins can change their shape. So one of the tasks is to know exactly in a very precise way the difference in shape, and especially to determine what we would call a high-resolution structure of the infectious form of the prion protein. So that's one important goal on the horizon. And it's also known that prion diseases come in slightly different varieties that can affect the same type of animal. And this phenomenon is called strains, or the different types of isolates are called strains. Strain is a word that's used in terms of conventional viruses. There are different strains of viruses like influenza. Prions are not viruses. They're a different type of infectious agent, but there are sub-varieties, and we suspect that those sub-varieties are due to actually, again, slightly different versions of different shapes, different bad shapes, as it were, and one of our goals is to precisely define these different bad shapes. And one last item that's been around for quite a while, but it is very fascinating, but certainly a thorny problem, is working out the role of these cellular prion proteins that we harbour within our body. We now, in fact, know that we have two types of cellular prion proteins in our brain cells. We have suspicions as to what they do, but again, in a sort of very precise, high-resolution way of assigning a particular function to the molecules, we're still working away at that. So I think this is one of our long-term goals, is to solve this riddle. These cellular prion proteins that are within our body, they don't look like other proteins, so in one way that makes the problem more difficult, because we just can't say that, well, this molecule looks like another molecule we know about, and we know that the other molecule does something very specific, and therefore it's clear that our molecule must do something similar. So we don't have that sort of background information, but from a more optimistic perspective, it means, well, these molecules do something new, that there isn't a precedent for what they do. They somehow help protect brain cells, and we hope that they are going to open a new doorway into how brain cells function and the way in which brain cells might protect themselves from damage.
So just so that I understand this, does that mean then we all have the prion cells? We just don't know what they're doing right now, or are they there just waiting to be misfolded and aren't, other than that, don't have a useful purpose?
I think that we all have them. They're the components of our cells. Mammals have about 30 to 40,000 genes in them, and each gene makes a different type of protein, and in fact each gene can make slightly different versions of protein, but we have two genes that make prion proteins. They're very ancient in evolution, so all mammals have them, and you can go down and look in other organisms, for example fish. Fish have five prion genes, so they're very ancient genes, and the proteins must do something useful. We think it's to do with protecting nerve cells. So that's one shouldn't really use the word purpose in biology from a sort of Darwinian perspective, but the proteins don't exist to make us sick. They serve a purpose, and it's what we have to understand is how very, very occasionally the proteins can go wrong, that a normal healthy protein can be rearranged into a nasty protein that causes an infectious disease.
With these different subclasses of the prions, are some more virulent than others when they're misfolded, or are some people or animals more susceptible to different ones?
Well, I think both of those points are substantially correct. The different subclasses have different types of virulence. It should be said you can't really escape virulence, that these are fatal diseases. They're incurable. So, unfortunately, the outcome is grim in either instance, but it may be that one type of subclass just causes the disease to proceed more quickly. And in terms of susceptibility, well, there's two, there are two criteria that operate here. Yes, some people and organisms have higher susceptibility to prion infections due to the variety, some minor variations in the normal prion proteins that are encoded by the gene. So there's a sort of genetic susceptibility. The most famous example of this is a minor change in the middle of the human prion protein, where people either have one version of an amino acid in the middle of the protein called methionine, or they have another version called valine. And depending on whether a person is a methionine, because people carry two copies of every single gene, so they can either be a methionine person, or a methionine valine person, or a valine valine person, and that single chain has quite a dramatic influence on the outcome of different prion diseases. The other operational factor with regard to susceptibility is within the prion itself, the infectious prion, and here we come back to these strains and whether they affect how prion disease is spread. And it's thought, at least for some strains, that there may be some that like to stay within a certain type of animal and behave themselves and just cause a disease in that animal and can't jump to another animal. But it may well be that some strains of prion diseases have a greater capacity to transfer from one type of animal to another without respecting what we would call a species barrier. And here the most famous example is mad cow disease itself, BSE, which surprised everyone by being able to infect quite a wide variety of mammals.
What's exciting you now about the research you're involved in?
Well, I think we're getting close to solving some of these mysteries. I think we're getting close to solving the mysteries of what prion proteins normally do in a healthy body. We're getting the tools and the background to solve the problem of the very high resolution structure of prions. And from a personal point of view, we're getting excited about using all our new high-tech equipment to close in on these problems and bring them to resolution.
Thank you very much, David.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. David Westaway, a professor in the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry at the University of Alberta. He is the director of the Center for Prions and Prion Folding Diseases, and he is an Alberta Ingenuity Prion Institute scholar. One scientist looking at what makes some cows more susceptible to mad cow disease than others is Dr. Stephen Moore. Stephen is the chair of bovine genomics at the University of Alberta, and he is the scientific director for the Alberta Prion Research Institute.
Okay, well, genomics is the study of the animal's entire genetic makeup. That's all the genes in the animals, how they work together, etc. The PRP protein, or the prion, is a gene that's or a protein that's produced by the animal itself. It's part of its genome. So in that context, where the study of prion disease is a big part of animal genomics.
So what is the focus of your research then, looking at the genomics and BSE?
Okay, so we know there's in some TSEs in some prion diseases, such as Scrapion sheep, that there's a genetic component that affects whether or not the animal will come down with disease or at what age it will come down with disease. The interesting thing about cattle is they don't have the genetic mutations in the PRP gene or the prion gene itself. But there are other genes affecting the disease, and we're looking to see if we can find those other genes because it will give us insights into the way the disease progresses.
How would you do that?
Well, we do what's called a whole genome scan. In other words, what we do is we look at point mutations right across all the chromosomes that cattle have. They have 30 chromosomes, to see if we can associate any of those genetic variants or point mutations with things like detection of disease in a group of animals. So it's like a case control study in cancer research where you look at people who have a certain cancer and people of similar background or related people who don't have the disease, and to see if we can find an association in the genetic makeup of the people for disease susceptibility or resistance.
Now, my understanding is that when you're handling any material that has the BSE in it, that it's very, very infectious. So what are you doing to protect yourself and your researchers?
Okay, yes, very infectious is a relative term. There is, in fact, quite a species barrier between BSE and humans, which is why we've only seen a very few cases of variant CJD worldwide. There were probably 2 million people exposed and only 100 and something people came down with that disease. But we don't work with the infectious material. We work with the genetic material, the DNA from the animals, which has had all the proteins removed. And we did this in England. The protein part of the samples did not come to Canada at all, just the DNA. So all those extractions were done and deactivations were done in the UK, in Scotland, by a couple of my grad students who had to spend a couple of weeks in Edinburgh to do that.
What have you found so far?
So far we've found an association with actually part of the PRP gene itself, but it's the part of the gene called the promoter, which is kind of the volume control on a gene. So the promoter affects how much a gene is expressed, how much of that protein you will make. And there is a mutation in the promoter that is associated with susceptibility to disease or time onset of disease. The mutation is more prevalent in animals that have the disease than don't have the disease. We've also found four other regions of the genome, four other spots on chromosomes that seem to have an effect on whether or not the animal has the disease, as opposed to its close relatives or its compatriots that were in the same environment. We don't know what those genes are yet. The next phase of this study is to find out what the genes are. All we have at the moment is a location on a chromosome. So there might be 1,000 possible genes in that location. So we're fine mapping those locations now to see if we can reduce the number of the what we call candidate genes down from 1,000 to maybe a handful of 4 or 5. Then we'll investigate those 4 or 5 one by one.
Well, do you know at this point if there's any difference between, say, the British cows and those that are here in Canada? Because over in Britain they had so many cases and here we've had just a handful.
I think with the way animal breeding works worldwide these days, there's probably little difference between the genetic makeup of, for instance, dairy cattle in the United Kingdom and in North America. Common bulls are used right around the world with artificial insemination being widely used. Really, the number of cases in the United Kingdom was a result of them recycling the disease by feeding back infectious material to animals over a fair number of years. Once they stopped doing that, the disease declined. That amplification hasn't happened in North America. So we stopped feeding those things to animals early enough to stop the disease being amplified. And that's the major reason we've only seen this sort of bumping along of 1 or 2 animals being detected rather than the thousands of animals that were detected in the United Kingdom.
Are there different strains of the disease?
Yes, there's been 3 strains identified of BSE identified to date. There's what we call the United Kingdom strain, which was the one that caused all the problem and was exported around the world through either export of animals or export of meat and bone meal. And then there's been what we call atypical strains of BSE, and there's been a number of those detected, one in Canada, two in the US, and I believe another four cases, or maybe five in Europe, of these two atypical strains of BSE.
When you get to the point where you have identified the genes that are responsible for, you know, whether or not an animal is going to get BSE if it's exposed, what happens then? What's the significance of that?
Well, the real significance of that is to help us understand what's happening during this disease. I mean, the real issue about TSEs or prion disease in general is the fact that this misfolding of a protein can cause a disease. It's not the only disease caused by misfolded proteins, but it's the only one we know that's transmissible, or you can transmit from one animal to another in various ways. We don't understand why this gets out of control. Why is it that the normal processes of cleaning out these misfolded proteins that the body has, because as proteins get older, they do misfold. Usually the body takes care of that. There's a way to flush those things out, to destroy them, to get rid of them. We don't understand why that doesn't happen in something like prion disease or Alzheimer's disease. And insights into that would be very useful to us in learning how we might avoid or control the disease. So I think the major thing we'll find out is to understand the disease a little bit more by knowing what other proteins or what other genes are involved in the progression of the disease.
You've just come back from China. What's happening in China?
Well, China has an active program in surveillance for TSEs, both Scrapie sheep and BSE in cattle. They're following the OIE guidelines on the number of animals they need to test. So, and they're doing that, and they found no cases of BSE to date. There is scrapie in China, as there are in many places of the world, including Canada. Of course, scrapie has never been an issue because it's not transmissible to human beings. It's restricted to the sheep. So, but we would all like to get rid of that disease as well, because it's not very pleasant for the sheep and it affects production. So they've got active surveillance programs. We're investigating ways we might work together, both on the research front in particular, how we could involve Chinese scientists in some of the work we're doing here in Canada.
You're also the scientific director of the Alberta Prion Research Institute. What's the Institute doing now? What's some of the exciting areas that you're working in?
Well, what's nice about the Institute is we have a broad program. We work on everything from very basic studies in protein folding and misfolding right through to the societal effects of something like BSE. So how did BSE affect rural communities economically and socially, and how can we better prepare for this sort of thing if it happens again in support mechanisms? There was criticism of the support mechanisms at the time, if you recall. And we've got everything in between, from looking at decontamination, which I think is one of the big issues. How can we make sure that what comes out of our production system is not going to be a danger to anybody? And we're doing a good job on that. We're looking at the pathobiology of the disease, in other words, looking at how the disease develops. We're looking at population genetic studies. What are the populations of the wild animals in Alberta and Canada, or North America for that matter, that are susceptible to things like chronic wasting disease? How is that disease spreading through the wild populations? Understanding that can help us better control the spread of the disease, we hope. We want to get away from the drastic measures that are being taken at the moment, which is large-scale culling of animals, which a lot of people are getting upset about. So if we can understand how the populations move through the region, they don't stop at the border, they wander across quite freely. But we don't know a lot about the range that animals have and how far they wander, etc. So that work's being done here in Alberta in collaboration with groups in Saskatchewan. So there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening. We're collaborating with groups around the world. Some of the top groups in the world are coming to Alberta to collaborate. We have studies here at the university with groups in Switzerland, for example, looking at producing antibodies to the PRP protein in plants, so that we can have an abundant source of these antibodies that we can use in research to understand the misfolding of the protein better.
Certainly there's lots of questions, but is there anything that we found out for sure yet?
That's an interesting question. I think what we found out for sure is we know there are things like genetic susceptibility. It's a bad word, susceptibility, but it's the one we have. We're gaining insights into the mechanism of misfolding. It's a very difficult question to answer because the misfolded proteins are very difficult to work with. They're basically this insoluble glug that's very difficult to handle. We're understanding better what happened in Alberta with BSE to the economies of the rural communities. There's some really nice work being done on that. We're understanding better the pressures that cattle producers were put under at the time, so that we hope that government can have better policy in future for anything like this if it ever happens again, and we all hope it doesn't.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Stephen Moore, chair of bovine genomics at the University of Alberta. He's also the scientific director of the Alberta Prion Research Institute. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, Genome Alberta, the Alberta Conservation Association, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.